need every possible tool, every mechanism, especially and at least until there is a replacement. So beyond this being done on Sunday, what is the plan?
Yeah, so they're going to be decommissioned on Sunday, and you know that technology will start to be taken down. And then the mayor is looking for requests from other gunshot detection technology. And so they're going to go through this request for information, for proposals process. And the mayor says his intention is to contract with another form of technology. And so it's kind of contradictory to his overall argument that technology like this leads to the over-policing.
Right. Explain that.
But, you know, you shift and you change from campaigning to governing, and that might just be one of those inflection points for him. We'll just have to see. And, you know, he's not ruling out recontracting with ShotSpotter, though that would be a long shot. But, you know, you go through this formal request for proposals, request for information process, and see what you get back. You try to negotiate the best deal, and that's what the mayor says he's going to take, you know, months to do. There is a transition period from, you know, now through November that they'll, you know, work with the police department to transition away from using the technology.
And what will each of you be watching? The mayor, when questioned, said he doesn't necessarily have a timeline. The timeline is however long it takes to get it right. Hannah?
Well, something like this, like, you know, putting out another RFP and waiting for responses and, you know, vetting all of these candidates, that could take a very, very long time. And by the time a process like that is, you know, basically cooked, who knows what kind of environment we're going to be in. Who knows what the demand might be. It might be something that is just put on the back burner and is permanently left on the back burner.
Right. Well, and we're, yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, this company, Sound Thinking, they've appeared before a city council committee, and they're saying starting Sunday, we're going to start to take the equipment down. So it could be very costly if the city actually tried to backtrack and keep ShotSpotter, you know, as days and weeks and months pass. And another thing, it's not at all clear that there is another company like that could put up anything like ShotSpotter. So what kind of technology are they talking about?
So, Mariah, you wanted to cut
in
there.
Well, I'm just saying, most immediately, we're looking to whether the mayor is going to veto this proposal. He says he's intended to veto it. He calls it illegal. The city's corporation council says it's a violation of the Separation of Powers Act, that the legislative branch can't compel the executive branch to enter into a contract. This might play out during budget season. Aldermen might try to, you know, earmark, you know, funding for ShotSpotter in that budget process. But I think we have a long way to go. In order to veto, Johnson has to hold a city council meeting where he will issue the veto. City council members can then vote to override. And you know, they were just one vote short of the veto-proof majority. And so if they
Although
decide...
Although he says even if they do, it's illegal.
Do we see a court fight?
Aside from all of that, put this in perspective. How historic is the fact that we even could be seeing a veto and potential for an override?
Well, it is historic. The last mayoral veto we saw was in 2006 when Richard Daley vetoed an ordinance that would require big box retailers to pay their employees more. And in Chicago, you know this, you know, mayors don't have to issue vetoes often because they have so much control over what legislation comes up for a vote in the first place through controlling chair appointments, chairmanships. And so it would be a very big deal to see, you know, Johnson issue a veto on this.
You know, Johnson seemed to bristle really at the notion as well that his relationship with the city council is rocky despite this vote, despite questions over sort of where he's at with CPS and ties to the CTU, and then also really didn't seem to appreciate when a reporter said you pivoted from choosing your zoning chair. So, Maria, stick with you on this. Just your thoughts. Is this a rocky relationship, or, as the mayor says, is this just change and a different set of values than Chicago, to which Chicago's accustomed?
I think when you line up all of these different instances, they have their own unique nuances that make them, you know, contentious and controversial in the city council. But the fact that we're seeing so many of them, I think, is indicative of someone who's never held executive office before and who is kind of learning as we go how to play politics with the city council. In the ShotSpotter instance, you know, the mayor gets to his majority in city council through allies in the Black Caucus and progressives on the council. And in this case, allies in the Black Caucus are very pro-ShotSpotter and want, you know, some of them. Others, like Alderman Jason Irvin, are not. And so there's not consensus in the way. And so you see what I'm saying? Like, you mm-hmm. can kind of
it's
tease out nuances from each of these, though, you know, I think we should all take the point that it's been rocky in different ways, including the committee chairmanship.
There's another political dynamic that could play out as well. You know, when ShotSpotter is decommissioned starting on Sunday, there will be shooting deaths in which nobody called 911. And there will be publicity about
the shooting. Nobody calls because they didn't hear it.
They didn't hear it because people don't trust the police. Right, exactly. So those will get publicity, and there could be a political toll that Johnson will pay, and it'll be drip, 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 drip. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
I also want to point out what I thought was interesting about your interview was the researcher said that, you know, in an ideal world where the police had the resources that they needed, ShotSpotter would be an excellent asset,
Sort of supplemental?
Yes, a supplemental thing. But in this world, like you said, when police are sending resources to ShotSpotter events that turn out to not be anything, then yes, you're putting resources away from, you know, real events.
It's a police department of scarcity.
Right, which is the broader context in which, you know, a lot of these things play out.
And we're continuing to see, I know the mayor continually pointing out he wants to hire and plans to hire more detectives, but that's not necessarily going to be enough to fill that gap, Jim.
Well, we'll have to see.
All right. Well, let's move on to ethics. And Hannah, a hung jury in the case against former AT&T executive Paul Esquiaza, who was charged for a scheme in which he allegedly bribed former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan to get a law passed in Springfield by hiring a Madigan ally to lobby, but not actually lobby.
Right. It's not your classic envelope of cash. In fact, you know, that's not really the word that was used over and over again in this two-week trial is, you know, it was much more sophisticated than that. So the allegation is that, yes, AT&T gave basically a no-work contract to a 20-year veteran of the Illinois House after he'd retired in 2017, ally of Madigan, and in a time when AT&T finally saw an opening to pass their major legislation to end the 1930s-era obligation to maintain these, like, old copper wires that they felt like were holding them back from investing in things like broadband and cellular. And so in these four days of testimony, we saw, you know, more than a dozen witnesses. And it was really, really interesting to see that the first note that the jury sent out, they had gotten the case on Tuesday afternoon. On Wednesday morning, they sent out a note to the judge asking something very specific about whether to prove a bribe, you have to actually, you know, get the thing that...
Is it the offer
right.
is it the gift?
And so it turns out, you know, they hung. They couldn't reach any sort of resolution, even after the judge sent them back yesterday to try again.
What is this juror holding up?
It was just one juror. Credit to my colleagues at the Tribune who had tracked down a juror that would actually divulge what happened in the jury room. And they were caught up in the idea that, you know, the intent was not there. And so if Paul Esquiaza had intended to bribe, but, you know, his defense all along was like, this was just a blip on the radar and, like, a request came in. Yes, it came in from a very close confidant of Mike Madigan, but it did not connect in their minds to the legislation that they're trying to pass, and the jury found that convincing.
So are they going to try again?
Well, the parties are going to meet in front of the judge on Tuesday to decide next steps forward, which could include a retrial, but if that does happen, likely it wouldn't be scheduled until, you know, probably next year, because the next big thing on the docket is Mike Madigan's own bribery and racketeering trial.
We'll all be watching that, of course. So former House Speaker.
That starts a couple weeks from now.
What does this mean for Madigan? Anybody?
It could mean a lot, or it could mean nothing. I think it's a lot. It depends on the specific group of 12 people who are in the jury room. You know, the Tribune had...
Could be that one juror
yes.
again.
And so, you know, if, you know, maybe it was a different group of people, it wouldn't have ended that way. You know, there's a lot more, though, in the case of Mike Madigan. There's many, many more counts. And you have not just the bribery, but it's also the racketeering charges.
Well, we will all be watching that soon. I know, Hannah, you'll be in the courtroom. Now, Chip, it has been a year since Illinois passed a law that, well, not since passed a law, but since implemented a law that completely eliminates cash bail. How's that going?
Well, jail populations, for one thing, are down. Not as much as maybe a lot of people expected. Here in Cook County, we're down only out of about we're down to about 5,000, just a tad over 5,000. That's only less than 400 less than we had a year ago. So we've millions of dollars have been saved in communities that otherwise would have been spent on bond. A lot of that money lost, not finding its way back to the families. Some Loyola University researchers are studying 21 counties, the most exhaustive study that's going on. In the first 6 months after cash bail's elimination, they counted $6.7 million in avoided bond costs in those counties. Warrants for failure to appear in court decreased slightly, and crime has not shot up. This is the big warning that a lot of people in the law enforcement world, prosecutors, sheriffs, the police unions, they were warning that we'd have all these murderers out and that crime would shoot up. That has not happened. Now, there's not a, in fact, crime, violent crime and property crime have continued to come down. There's not a causal relationship, but there was not a big surge in crime as a result of eliminating cash bail in Illinois.
And what are your takeaways, Rima? Because this is something that, as Chip alluded to, really detractors had said, the sky is truly falling.
Yeah, and you kind of hear that, I feel like, in other communities that toy with this idea or consider it. And it was very interesting to read that, you know, that's it's true that the sky is not falling, that, really you don't have, the streets overridden with violent criminals. And I mean, I also thought it was really interesting just learning about how, prosecutors still do have the option of asking a judge to detain a violent allegedly violent offender. I didn't know that. And that actually in 60% of those instances, judges have said, yes, okay,
yeah,
fine.
Judges can seek, prosecutors can petition for it. And then there's an argument about it now. And then the judge has the final word. Is this defendant pretrial a threat to public safety or a threat to flee and not keep court appointments? And so it's been, most people in the system, including prosecutors, say that it's working pretty well and they've been working it out.
So not all, Hannah, right? We have some prosecutors who say that the list of offenses that you prosecutors are able to ask a judge to detain someone too short?
Yeah, and that's been a constant for, I don't know, it's been, 2 years since we even touched the Safety Act to, amend that, to add to that list, but not enough for to satisfy some of those prosecutors. I think it's now been almost 4 years since the General Assembly passed this. It's been a year, of course, since the part of this,
the elimination of cash bail portion.
Mm-hmm. From the beginning, it's been a failure of communication. The communication plan was not there from the beginning. I think there was a lot of folks who were understandably very confused and upset. I think, it's our colleagues in the media, not all of us did the best job of communicating it, but I think it came from the folks who were trying to put this out. They did not have the most solid communication plan, and so it goes back to that when it's almost 4 years later and people are still confused, people still don't understand what it is.
Well, thank you for communicating those concerns, as I tell my husband. Communication, communication, communication. All comes down to that in policy and in personal life. We are out of time. Our thanks to Rima Amin, Mariah Wolfel, Hannah Meisel, and Chip Mitchell. We will be back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Chicago Tonight, Week in Review, is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown, and the Mullenhauer Progressive Philanthropic Fund, in honor of Ida Mullenhauer, supporting quality journalism. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that is our show for this Friday night. Looks like we're in store for a sunny Saturday. So head to our website, check out our picks for outdoor adventures this weekend. And tonight, the new series of Chicago Stories kicks off, and this week's episode explores the deadly alliance between Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb and their efforts to commit the, quote, perfect crime. Didn't go that way. That's tonight at 8 or anytime at WTTW.com/Chicago Stories. And now for the Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thanks so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe and have a good night. Now, Mariah, we talked a lot about what went on in the city. What we haven't talked about is the mayor won't share whether or not he's going to accept a pay increase.
Yeah, it's pretty silly because this is going to come out in October. It's a FOIable information of whether or not city officials are taking this 4.1% increase. But, you know, it's a controversial story. Public officials get dinged for, you know, taking these pay increases in light of a budget hole. And so maybe it's just like, let's just delay, you know, the
putting
negative
off
press
the inevitable.
until I don't know.
It's similar that, you know, every year a similar thing happens in Springfield because I guess a quirk, I should know this like much better from all the years
covering it.
A quirk of, you know.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to give back to its community in Chicago and beyond.